Several years ago, there was a book published. The title was something like The Day That America Told the Truth. And it was a series of surveys that people had taken and answered. And I'm skeptical of surveys. How do they know America told the truth? Well, they did a survey and asked, I guess. But it is intriguing to see surveys, at least to see the numbers they come up with, see how they may change from time to time. But at that time, one of the things they were asked was, what would you do, what would you be willing to do for $10 million? Well, that was a lot more money back then, I guess, but 25% would be willing to cut themselves off from their entire extended family. If you just had to forget any contact with brothers, sisters, you know, grandma, 25%. 23% were willing to spend a week working as a prostitute for $10 million. 16% would leave their spouse for $10 million. And 3% would put their kids up for adoption. I'm glad at least to see that toward the bottom of the list there. But we're coming back to our parables, and we're looking in Luke chapter 16, the parable of the unrighteous steward or the unjust manager, something like that. And it's one of the many places that Jesus talks about money. Jesus talked about money pretty much more than anything else. And second to that, he talks about hell. And hell and money are two things a lot of people don't want to hear about. And yet, we do need to talk about these money matters because money does matter, certainly. And in this story, there's this man. He's called unrighteous, unjust. He's guilty in some way of defrauding his master, whether it's just through sheer incompetence or more conscious than that. You're probably familiar with the story. So Luke 16, verse 1, he was saying to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager. This manager was reported to him as squandering his possessions. Now, you may realize, of course, Luke's not the one that put these chapter divisions here. The last time we heard somebody squandering something was the prodigal son in the previous story. And you see a whole series of lessons that Jesus has been giving about money. The rich young ruler is going to come up later here in Luke chapter 16. We'll make some more observations about that in a moment. So here's another guy who's squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an accounting of your management, for you can no longer be manager. In other words, turn in the books. I'm firing you. You must turn in the books. And the manager said to himself, what shall I do? Since my master is taking the management away from me, I'm not strong enough to dig, which is manual labor. He had this white-collar job, and going to this blue-collar job would be a real blow to him. And I'm ashamed to beg. That's even worse. I know what I'll do, so that when I am removed from the management, people will welcome me into their homes. And he summoned each one of his master's debtors, and he began saying to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill, sit down quickly and write 50. And he said to another, how much do you owe? He said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous manager because he had acted shrewdly, for the sons of this age are more shrewd in relation to their kind than the sons of light. And I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of the wealth of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will receive you into the eternal dwellings. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. He who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. And therefore, if you have not been faithful in the use of unrighteous wealth, who will entrust the true riches to you? And if you have not been faithful in the use of that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, were listening to all these things and were scoffing at him. And he said to them, you are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts. For that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God. So what's going on in this story? Well, I think we need to envision a very wealthy person, the person who has employed this manager to carry on his affairs for him, and that means keeping the books, all the other wealthy people that owe him money. And these are enormously wealthy people that owe these great debts to this master. We're just given two illustrations here, and I think we get the gist of this, that he called in every single one of them and adjusted the debt accordingly. And so the first guy, he owes 100 measures of oil. This is about 875 gallons of oil, which is about what 150 olive trees could produce. It would be worth about 1,000 denarii, so 1,000 days' pay, so about 3 years' worth of pay. And when he cuts the bill in half, he has given this man a 500 denarii benefit. So what would take him a year and a half to work off, of course he's probably not working at some labor job, but that's how long it would take to pay off just the part of the debt that is forgiven. And then the second guy owes 100 measures of wheat. And you might look at this and say, well, he doesn't get as good a deal. He only gets this 20% discount instead of a 50% discount. But this 100 measures of wheat, that equals about 1,100 bushels. Or to put it in liters for you metric types, that's 39,000 liters. Since we now drink Coca-Colas in liters, I guess you can kind of envision how much that would be. This would be the produce of about 100 acres of grain, which was an enormous plot of land. And the debt amounts to about 2,500 to 3,000 denarii. And so when he gets a discount, it's roughly the same discount as the first guy got, a 500 denarii benefit that the manager is giving to him. And furthermore, I think it's easier to understand this story in terms of, okay, he's been fired. He's no longer the manager. He has no authority to continue to conduct affairs on part of his master. But he's got to figure out some system to, you know, make him, you know, make some people like him that they're going to be willing to give him a job or take care of him after he loses his job. And I get the impression that he calls these people in individually. And they might even get the idea that, hey, I'm getting a special treatment here. And don't tell anybody about this, you know. He doesn't just bring them all in as a group and say, hey, I'm going to adjust all of your debts. That would probably alarm people and say, well, something's up here. And maybe this guy's a shyster. Why would I want to employ him later just because he gave me a good deal at the expense of his earlier master? So if it is not known that he's a cheat and he's working a good deal for these people, and it then puts the master kind of an awkward situation because he can come back and say, this guy's a crook, I fired him, he had no right to do this, all these contracts are null and void, you still owe the full amount, and I'm going to send this guy to prison. But of course, that would take a great deal of difficulty on the part of the master because these people are out celebrating. They're enjoying the fact they've gotten this great deal. They are rejoicing in the fact that presumably the master had been so benevolent to them. They wouldn't assume that this guy's just doing it on his own. Surely he's representing his master and adjusting these debts. And now we're being told, no, it's all a con game and we've been had and now we still owe all this money. And so it would seem that the master is willing to let all that go. Yeah, you know, you've pulled one over on me here. And there's no indication the master is going to go squeeze everybody for all the money they originally owed. He's going to allow these people in their villages just to enjoy the bounty that they have received here. But it speaks to the same kind of character as the father in the previous story. He was willing to part with a third of all that he had, gave it to his son, who went and squandered it all, that he might win his son back. Well, that's not a very practically minded father. Or the guy back in chapter 14 who's going to give a great party and nobody wants to come, at least all the big shots. And so we'll go and beat the bushes and get all the lame people and the poor people, all the nobodies. I want them to come to my party. Well, nobody in their right mind would lavish this great party on the bunch of nobodies. No father in his right mind would reward his child for being such an idiot and going out and squandering his money and so on. Now, that takes someone who's awful generous. And I think the same is true of this master. And so, you know, of course, all of these characters represent God, and what we're getting reinforced time and again is God doesn't think about money the way we do. You know, he's not counting every penny and viewing it as the be-all and end-all of what's important. And that's really the ultimate point of this story. In verse 15, the Pharisees all care about money. But what is exalted in the sight of man is worthless to God. You think money's important, it's nothing. And that which is of value to God is despised by man. And that's what we need to recognize in the background of this story. And so God is rather liberal with his money. He's rather impractical with his money. He's rather wasteful with his money from a human point of view. And indeed, when we look at that in spiritual terms, it is obvious. You know, how extravagant can you get but to give the blood of your own son for the stupidity and sin of the world? And what a waste it has been upon the untold millions of people who reject the salvation that is so freely offered to them. They don't deserve it. Well, indeed, as none of us do. And so it's in this context we need to understand what is happening here with money. But we do learn some principles about the use of money, because that undergirds the story of the parable. And so when it comes to money, what do you do with God's money? Well, first of all, you don't waste it. This is really things not to do with money. So you don't waste it. That's what this fellow had done. He was squandering. He was wasteful, just like the prodigal son in the previous story. It's just money. But it is money. And that's kind of the attitude we ought to have as Christians. We don't despise money to the degree to which we renounce it at all. It is a blessing from God. It is a means by which we can do good in this world. We just need to make sure we are master of it rather than it being master of us. And so we shouldn't be wasteful. We shouldn't be careless about the money that God has entrusted to us. Secondly, of course, we don't love it. This is what Jesus emphasized. You can't serve two masters. I know a lot of people think that's about polygamy, but no, it's about serving either God or money, one or the other. And you're going to either love the one and hate the other, or vice versa, right? And so don't love money. Don't get so enamored of money. Also, don't trust money. That's the part we really have a problem with. You remember we already read this passage earlier in connection with the parable of the rich fool back in Luke chapter 12. But at the end of 1 Timothy, where Paul is giving instructions to Timothy as a preacher in Ephesus, where there are a lot of wealthy Christians, he says in chapter 6 and verse 17, "Instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy." Don't put your trust in money. It is not trustworthy. "Instruct them to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, storing up for themselves the treasure of a good foundation for the future, so they may take hold of that which is life indeed." I remember, back in Proverbs 23 and verse 5, it says, if you set your sight on money, it'll take wings like an eagle and fly away. That's how untrustworthy, unreliable money can be. It seems like it's here one day and gone the next. And you have that problem that if you really do put your trust and love in money, then as Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 10 says, it's never enough. What does it take to make you happy? Well, just a little bit more, and then a little bit more, and a little bit more. And you just keep being bled dry spiritually because we keep pursuing just a little bit more. I'll be happy if I just have a little bit more. And it never is true. It never does satisfy. Well, what is this money, really, when we think about it? And these are some principles we've highlighted before that we don't need to dwell as much on, but first of all, we simply remind ourselves it is a trust, it is a stewardship, it's God's money. You know, the cattle on 1,000 hills belong to God already. So what sacrifice are you going to bring to God that he doesn't already own? You know, we gather together as a local congregation and we give a contribution. And sometimes we talk about that as giving back to the Lord. And that's okay. That is true that we're giving back to the Lord, but we're also giving back to the Lord when we pay our mortgage in order to provide a roof over the heads of our family and take care of them. We are giving back to the Lord when we buy food in order to feed our families or others who are hungry. You know, we're constantly giving our money back to the Lord because it's always His. And we're always trying to be a good steward. Okay, here's the sum total of resources God has given me stewardship of. Now, how am I going to allocate these resources? And the totality of the money I give to the Lord is not to be equated with what I put in the treasury of a local congregation. Now, the reason I do that is because I'm part of the congregation. I believe in the work that it is doing. I want to do my fair share to support it and help it to meet its financial needs. But that's not the only money that belongs to God. It's all this other money I have that I'm using belongs to God also. And so it is a trust, and we're reminded of that constantly. And so in the story, you have God who is the master, the rich man, and he has this manager who is managing his, at least some of his affairs for him, and that's us. We are managing the resources that God has entrusted to us. Sometimes we're given a great deal of resources to manage, and sometimes just a little. And of course, it isn't just money. God might give to some of us a lot of time on this earth, and some of us just a short time. Or we have a lot of energy, a lot of creativity, a lot of connections with people. There's lots of different forms in which the blessings of God come, but every last one of them is God's. And not a thing that we've earned for ourselves, not a thing that we've done or made for ourselves, but it is all God's. And so this problem of being a good steward extends to far more than just whether we're a good steward with money or not. Secondly, money is a tool. I'm reminded of what was said about one preacher who was visiting in a home of a fabulously wealthy Christian. And he was just struck by the fact that this Christian seemed to have such a very down-to-earth attitude about everything. His money, just it belongs to the Lord, it's not his. They were talking about his dad and said, yeah, I understand your dad started with nothing and he died a billionaire. No, he died just as poor as the day he was born. You know, it's that kind of thing. And he said, well, how is it that you just seem to have such a common... And he said, well, Dad taught us that everything in our home is either an idol or a tool. And it's that perspective that you have to have about your stuff. Is it a tool that's actually helping to further the cause of God in this world? If it's not, then it's just an idol, or at best, a stumbling block that's preventing us from serving the Lord as we ought to do. And so, thinking of money as a tool, that's what Jesus says in verse 9. You know, make friends for yourself by means of the wealth of unrighteousness. Use it as a tool. But have as the goal some different outcome than what this guy did. We can have the tool and use it for some nobler purpose than what he did. Some have said that money is like manure. You spread it around, it does a lot of good. You pile it up, it just stinks. Well, that's what it is with this money as a tool. We spread it around. If we use it to further God's purpose, it's a good thing and we'll do good things with it. But we just pile it up, it's not going to be very helpful. And so, in terms of this tool, there's a couple of things we can learn from this unjust steward. First of all, he recognized his future. He didn't have a future. And he had to come up with a plan pretty quickly to consider the future and what he's going to do about that. And once he came up with his plan, he acted quickly to secure that future for himself. Well, he was using money as a tool to accomplish his purpose. Now, the fact that his purpose wasn't that great a purpose, that's not really the focus of the story. I think it's acknowledged he's unrighteous. He has dubious goals in his life. And Jesus is much more interested that we understand the spiritual implications of this. Do we know what our future is? And just as surely as the day that this steward got his pink slip, you're fired, your future is bleak, your outlook is nothing, you're a nobody. That's exactly what our outlook is without God. And so what are we going to do about it? Do we have a plan, and are we going to take action on that? You know, sometimes you got Christians and they think, well, you know, one day if I hit it big, I'm going to really help the Lord's church, or I'm going to really help people who are adopting kids, or I'm really going to help with this cause or that cause. And we're just deceiving ourselves if we're not already giving big relative to what we have. Let's not dupe ourselves into thinking when we get some kind of windfall, you know, that uncle is going to leave us $10 million, that we're going to suddenly become big givers. No, we start now giving big, proportionate to what we have. And then if we have a lot of money, we're going to give big then as well. You know, there's a passage back in Malachi, you know, chapter 3. And I guess it shouldn't surprise us that under the old covenant system, a lot of times the people didn't pay their tithes the way they should. And that wasn't just because they're chintzy and not doing what God had told them to do, but it also had implications for the people that lived off of the tithes, the priests and the Levites and the widows and the orphans, the poor people. They were provided for out of these tithes, and so if you're not doing your fair share, then that's going to cut into the ability to support these people. And so what did the Lord say about their withholding the tithe? Malachi chapter 3 and verse 10, "Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse so that there may be food in my house, and test me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until it overflows." Now, of course, some would take that passage and say it's a, you know, investment scheme in which, you know, you give so much money, the Lord's going to automatically give you a 1,000% return or something. Well, that's not what Malachi is talking about. But if you just trust the Lord enough to give him what he asks of you, then trust that the Lord is going to bless you, that you're not going to be deprived, you're not going to be cheated, that God is just, you know, greedily wringing his hand saying, boy, I'm going to see if I can get, you know, Dan to pony up this much money, and then, you know, he'll just feel like a real sucker when he finds out I'm not going to give him anything back. You know, God is a loving Father. He knows this is for our good. You know, when we're giving, it's not building up the bank account of a local church as much as it's building up the character of our own self. And that's what God's really building. That's what God's trying to increase. And so test him and see if we don't give ourselves to God, that he will not give ourselves so freely to us. And so here's this tool. And as man realizes what he can do with this tool to secure his future, well, what about us? It's a tool that we can use to secure an even greater future for ourselves. And then ultimately, of course, it is a test. That's what Jesus says in Luke chapter 16 and verse 10. He who is faithful in a very little thing is faithful also in much. It gets back to that principle again. If I have very little, and I'm willing to be liberal and generous with the little that I have, then I've proven myself to be faithful. And then if the Lord blesses me and I have more, and I can be equally liberal with that, then I will prove myself to be faithful as well. But the one who is unrighteous in a little thing, or unfaithful in a little thing, will also be unfaithful in the big things. And so the question here then becomes more, not can I trust the Lord to give like I should, to use my resources for others like I should. The question really is, can God trust us? Is there any reason for him to entrust me with a lot, given that I'm using it so poorly already? And so it's a test, and just like everything else, education is a test. What you do with it is going to show your character, whether you're faithful or not. Money is neither good nor bad of itself, but it's a test. Will it master you? Will you master it? And so finally, what is it Jesus really commends here in regard to this person. Well, I'm reminded of a statement Jesus made back in Matthew chapter 10 as he's about to send the disciples out on the limited commission, as we sometimes call it. It's really a pep talk to the disciples about going out and serving and finding suffering as a result, even as Jesus is the ultimate suffering servant. But he says in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 16, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves, so be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves." You know, when it comes to your moral fiber, you don't compromise. You maintain your purity, your innocence. But when it comes to wisdom, you need to have better sense than some Christians do, to have at least the same sense that the people of this world have when it comes to money. So in other words, here's a man who understands how to use money. And he's using this money for a rather despicable end. How much better if we could have as much sense about how to use money, but use it for some great purpose? That's really the comparison that Jesus is making in this parable. And so what is it specifically that Jesus would commend about this person, or that the rich man, the master, would commend about his dishonest servant? Well, first of all, what about his ambition? I mean, here's a man with some zeal, some drive, some determination. His attitude of self-preservation and so on, and it's misdirected, granted, and it results in this very greedy, kind of grasping kind of action. But wouldn't it be great if all of God's people had more zeal, more determination, more grit, more drive? That's what Jesus is getting at. And this guy has all of this for money, which is pretty worthless. Not nearly as important as the true treasures of heaven. And here people get all excited about money. They'll stop at nothing to make money. And you got Christians who stop at anything. Not to grow spiritually. Or not to share the gospel with people. Or any number of a million other things we could do spiritually. There's all kinds of things that'll stop us. That's what Jesus is getting at. Be the same kind of, nothing is going to stop me. But not for some petty thing, but for the great things that we've been called to in Jesus Christ. Secondly, you have to commend this fellow for his analysis. Constant and careful scrutiny of his situation, keenly looking carefully at his circumstances and figuring out what needs to be done. We need more Christians that do that. You know, sometimes it's like once I became a Christian, I just kind of coast along. You know, if a bump in the road comes along, well, maybe it'll wake us up a little bit and we'll pay attention for a while, then go back to sleep. But we need to be constantly subjecting our lives and our assumptions to the scrutiny of Scripture, the critique of God. What is Jesus like? And how far am I falling short of who Jesus is? I'm constantly making that analysis. And then, of course, you're formulating some plan. Okay, if this is who Jesus is, and I'm supposed to be like Jesus, and I'm missing it here, I really need to work on this, what's my plan? You know, this fellow, he didn't say, boy, I've got a terrible future I'm looking at here. I'm losing my job. I'm going to have nothing. Boy, that's really going to be bad. That's some fine kind of analysis, of course, but it's not going to do any good because you haven't come up with a plan. What are you going to do? And then, of course, he works the plan. He takes decisive and rather quick action. He's going to use money as long as he can manipulate it to secure his future. Will we use money just as surely in order to get us to heaven? You can't take it with you, but you can send it on ahead. You can invest in spiritual things, in eternal things. You can invest in people. You can invest in your own spiritual well-being. And that's what it means to be innocent as doves, but shrewd as serpents. That we need to have as much sense as the people of this world do. And yet sometimes it seems as if Christians, just by definition, are gullible. I mean, you see this time and again. It's like, you know, when Madeleine Murray O'Hare was alive, the former atheist, you know, because she changed her mind about that a few years back, you know, after she died. But there was this rumor that kept circulating for decades that she had this petition before the FCC to ban all religious broadcasting. And every once in a while, these various religious groups get all upset about that, and they do these mass letter-writing campaigns to the FCC, spending millions of dollars on printing and postage. The only problem was there was never any such proposal before the FCC. The FCC, for a while, would bother to respond and say, there is no such proposal, and they just gave up because of this constant deluge that would come in waves, you know. It'd die down for a while, and then it'd come back again. And who was it that was encouraging all of this? All these religious people spreading rumors, spreading gossip, not even having the sense to know whether something's true or not, and expending all this effort and money on something that's a complete fraud. Same people that would look at the Procter & Gamble box and see it had a little moon face on it or something. Oh, see, that's Satan worship. And all the people at Procter & Gamble, all the higher-ups, like Hope Chandler's dad was one of the higher-ups at Procter & Gamble. Satan worshipers, every last one of them. You know, I just thought, Brother Pollock, you know, what a terrible thing to say about him. And he's constantly having to put out these fires. No, it's just, you know, a symbol back from the 1800s when their company started. It had nothing to do with Satan. But, again, it's these gullible religious people. See, we just don't have sense sometimes. And, of course, we could talk all about idiotic things brethren get involved in. The list is way too long. We'll be here till, well, 50 years from now, I'm sure. Well, Jesus is telling us, people in the world have something to teach us about wisdom, how to be shrewd in the use of money. Now, again, they've misdirected it. And if we could rechannel that and realize that we can learn how to use money for a much greater purpose, so much the better. And so, I'm reminded of a statement that somebody made one time that money is the ultimate passport that will get you anywhere except heaven, and it's the ultimate provider that can get you anything except happiness. And there's a lot of truth to that. You know, money is very important in this world. But what's really important, it can't do a thing about. It ultimately fall short of bringing us true happiness and bringing us into the presence of God. And so, can we be wise to use money so it does not dominate us? And it's just a tool. It's our servant to do our bidding that will further the purpose of God in this world. And the sad reality is, when you think about those surveys, that people, what are you willing to do for $10 million? Give up your extended family? Give up your spouse? Give up your children? And the reality is so many people have done just that for far less sums of money. Just a regular $50,000 a year job. And I lose my family, I lose my kids, I lose my spouse. So it's not a hypothetical survey question. More down to earth, you know, what are we living for and what is important to us? And the fact that people would sacrifice relationships, what are the most important things we have in this life, it's what we were created for, and especially our relationship with God. That's the only thing of value that we really have, is our love for God and our love for our fellow man and serving those relationships. And I know the good people here know that. We just need to be reminded that we are stewards, not just of money, but we're also stewards of these relationships and nurturing them and using them to help secure our future with God and with one another. And it is my prayer that we will all make it to heaven together without the loss of a single one, and that we'll be able to see one another always without ever having to be separated, without ever having to pray for somebody's sickness or somebody's pain or somebody's passing, because we'll just be one family together in one house living with our Father for eternity. If you will, take your songbook out and turn to number 499. We've been singing songs about being like Jesus and imitating Jesus. And he had an awful lot to say about money, but mainly to remind us to put it in its place, to relativize its relative insignificance compared to the great things of value, the spiritual treasures that he has that he wishes to give us, to greatly shower upon us. And he will do that if we will put our trust in him. If there's some way we can be of help to anyone here this afternoon, this is a good time as any to let that be known while we stand and while we sing the song of encouragement.